Hello everyone. I wanted to make another video on traditionalism and how it relates to feminism. This video is kind of going to be a culmination of the past two admittedly long videos that I've made in regards to traditionalism. So I might reiterate some stuff here. So if you could just bear with me on that. But before I start, I just wanted to thank my subscribers for pushing me past the 6,000 subscriber mark. And I'm glad that even though I took over a month to post a new video, you guys kept subscribing. Much appreciation to my subscribers. But today we're going to talk about traditionalism. And although we may reiterate some points, we're going to flesh out some new concepts that relate to feminism and traditionalism and how it all relates to women. And how it affects men. Also, we're going to address the small government crowd and how essentially their plans consist of nothing more than feel-good moral, euphemistic platitudes. And this is the first thing that we're going to address in terms of how simply advocating for smaller government is not the answer. And you see the problem with advocating for simply a governmental or political solution to the problems that feminism has created is that it ignores the complex social variables at play. Variables which are rooted in human biology that caused feminism in the first place. Now, the reason that bleeding out that the solution is smaller government these days has become so popular is because it's intellectually lazy and functionally impossible to achieve without an understanding of what drives governmental behavior. Government is a social organism, which is at any given time involved in a symbiotic relationship with its people. This symbiosis is one which can be defined as parasitic mutualism. The state is demonstrably parasitic off its own people. The statesman, realizing that he can forcefully collect monies from his countrymen while doing comparatively little in terms of productive work in comparison to his countrymen, will, by virtue of human nature, seek to perpetuate his employ at the expense of his countrymen. In other words, the life of a politician is a comfortable one. It's an easy gig. So individual selfishness dictates that the politician will attempt to perpetuate the ease and comfort his occupation provides him. So if we pay attention to group dynamics, dynamics being a word for movement or motion, if we study the science of the movement of another social organism, that of schooling fish, for example, how it's been noted that younger fish almost never exhibit schooling behavior, which indicates to us that it's learned with time, not so much a group instinct, but a group behavior predicated on the instincts of the individual fish in any given school. You see, an individual fish has a lateral line sensory system that allows it to detect water displacement. These fish learn to pick up on a certain type of water displacement correlated to an adjacent fish attempting to escape a predator, and then mimic this movement instantly in hopes of escaping danger as well. And we see all sorts of other examples like this in nature. We see this in flocks of birds. We see it in locusts and so on and so forth. So what we end up seeing is this apparently uniform movement that in actuality is nothing more than a collection of the survival instincts of individual fish all matching up in a way that appears to be the conscious movement of the entire school of fish, as though the school itself was more than just the sum of its parts, and that is a social organism. Now, the instinct in the case of the individual politician, the power and relative luxury that he or she will live in comparison to the voter, the group dynamic we see in the social organism of government as a result of the individual political instinct is tending towards government growth. Now, it just so happens, unfortunately, that government also happens to provide a great many services necessary to maintain a civilized society. So it's a necessary evil in that sense. And it's with that said that I want you to consider the futility of claiming that the solution towards government largesse, which many claim to be the sole cause of feminism's destructive misandry amongst other negatives, is that of merely decreasing the size of government. And their stated logistics are to do this through the processes provided to them by government. It's a bit like saying there's too many bureaucrats in government, so we're going to elect more bureaucrats to decrease the amount of bureaucrats in government. The childish nature of the argumentation of less government is the only solution crowd, the logistical contradictions, or even the lack of any uniform game plan makes itself apparent in their oft-quoted Reaganesque axiom. Now, we've all seen before how they proudly tell you that government is not the solution, but the problem. And this is another feel-good moral platitude that they have no idea how to structure or implement in the real world. Remember that Reagan, the one who uttered the famous quote, said this on his inauguration day, meaning the day he started his term as the single most important individual in Western government. The demagoguery and blatant hypocrisy of the most influential single member of government telling the people that government is the problem is almost laughable, and history shows us that Reagan, like pretty much all other politicians before and after him, actually expanded the government significantly. And why? Well, because that's what politicians do. And, you know, yet these small government parakeets lap this stuff up in ecstasy, you know, a bunch of kittens playing around with catnip, patting themselves on the back for pointing out what exactly, you know, that problems arise from too much government. I mean, this has been known since the dawn of civilization. The problem is that it's almost a certainty that without a central governing authority, civilization cannot exist. And it's also a certainty that if a central governing authority exists, it will grow and grow and grow. So if you agree with me that government is a social organism, then the word organism should tell you that governments will seek to do what all other organisms seek to do, that is to maintain, grow, and reproduce itself perpetually. And it will do so even in systems of government that allow for votes to determine which particular politicians are in office. Since, after all, you know, one would be hard-pressed to find even one democratic government that hasn't consistently grown in size since its inception, and America's included in that. You have to remember that in certain cases, You have to remember that in certain cases, the people actively seek it out. And remember that government, for the most part, is a manifestation of prevailing social attitudes disguised as the will of the people. The reason why combating the female tendency to rely on government simply by limiting government is inefficient and ineffective is that as soon as it's perceived, for example, that women, let's take women who are hopelessly addicted to welfare, as soon as it's perceived or seen, you know, in some media outlet that women are being thrown out onto the street after their welfare gets cut off due to a simple reduction in government funding, and it will get to that point. Trust me, it will. I mean, these women are not going to up and get a job when the welfare meal tickets begin to dry up. But as soon as government is perceived to be tossing women out on the street for lack of welfare access for the poor oppressed women and their single mother offspring, you better believe that society will not tolerate it. You know, men can be the majority of homeless, but women never. It will not be allowed to go on, and it will be this way until there's simply no more money available to afford the luxury of the welfare mom. Because this society, you see, is not ready to force women to provide for themselves. At best, it's ready to clamor for a return to the times when individual men were providing for women. But somehow, some way, in this society, somebody better damn well make sure that women are being provided for. The same rule applies to a divorced woman. I mean, think about how ridiculous a status quo that expects men to maintain a divorced wife's standard of living years after they've divorced and she has another boyfriend. Think of any other transactional relationship where such bullshit can go unquestioned for even a second. This has been going on for the better part of 50 years. You don't get fired from a job and expect them to keep paying you. This utter hypocrisy can only exist in a society whose top priority, at least in terms of gender relations, is to bail out women before men, and in many cases, even before children. So again, government doesn't give the people what they say they want. It gives them what they know they want in doses large enough to satiate them, but small enough to continue the perpetual growth of government. There exist societal stopgaps in every society where a society is simply not willing to go. In this society, a society which is currently a hybrid of patriarchal chivalry and matriarchal socialism, the overarching stopgap in this society is one in which women must be protected and provided for at all times. This society, because of the unique cocktail that a transitory period from patriarchy to feminism provides, will bail out women every time at the expense of everyone but women and girls. Take that to the bank. The irony, of course, is that the single mother welfare queen derives her government sustenance by virtue of the vestiges of traditionalism that women have allowed to survive with calculating selectivity out of the families they've raised and burned to the ground. And the state was with them every step of the way. And why? Well, let's try to explain it this way. The small government folks will bleat on and on about putting an end to identity politics. And how do they intend to do this exactly? This is always the question with these people. How do you intend to do it? As I've just said, governments have not even a slight affinity towards shrinking themselves. These people simply have no stated plan as to how they intend to combat the female voting electorate, who most certainly will practice identity politics in the voting booth. Remember that to the female electorate, the personal is most certainly the political, and 51% of the population that is essentially guaranteed to vote for whoever gives them the most state-sponsored protection and provision cannot be combated by simply counting on the Mitt Romneys of the world to shrink government. I mean, it's almost laughable. It's so childish and vague. Instead of addressing the identity politics that women will implement with their equally potent votes, instead of identifying key prevailing social attitudes that are fixated on protecting women from harm at all costs, it's easier to lazily belch out, just shrink the government. You know, not how one intends to shrink it, just shrink it somehow. Vote for Mitt Romney. Well, yeah, but Mitt Romney never shrank government, and neither did Bush 1 or 2 or Reagan. And then they'll just bleed out, shut up, you leftist cultural Marxist. This man is a communist. And this is why, when me and Stardust mentioned Breifoldt's Law, an excellent analysis of the female family, the animal female family, these people latched on to the completely unrelated aspects of his personal views of government, his support of communism, instead of discrediting the actual observations made by Breifoldt's Law. You see, to these people, reality and the world itself needs to be divided into two black and white polar opposites. There is either right wing or there is liberal, and all of its synonyms, leftist, Marxist, communist, socialist, etc. They believe literally that the utterance of a fact by anyone they have deemed to be out of their fake conservative bubble will have his stated fact rendered false simply by a communist association. It's how they avoid scrutiny. If you point out valid, irreconcilable contradictions in their support for someone like Mitt Romney, they assume without any confirmation that you support Obama or leftism, etc. And if Breifoldt claimed that 2 plus 2 was 4, it would also be rendered invalid because he's a communist. Now, we've all seen it before, and I don't have to go into detail too thoroughly in terms of their hypocrisy here. But we do need to explore the ramifications of this Marxist conspiracy groupthink so as to avoid getting bogged down in the elite's engineered feminism mode of thinking. We live in a highly complex and variable society, and no one group of people, Marxists or otherwise, could ever engineer feminism without taking advantage of the human biology of the male and female. So, we often hear about cultural Marxism and how they, whoever they are, purposefully by the sheer power of some vast conspiracy theory, were able to double their taxpayer base by tricking women, the unsuspecting poor little darlings that they were. The truth is substantially less tinfoil hat-ish, however. If the big, bad, omnipresent cultural Marxists did anything to help this along, they provided a spark to what was already poised to unfold organically. You see, Western familial custom, having women as the idol proponent of the family unit, essentially created a vast, untapped resource for the free market to act upon. Now, what does traditionalism do? It creates women in an infantilized and atrophied state of perpetual childhood. I mean, she defers all responsibility to the male provider and is content with whatever menial responsibilities are left over. That's the perfect drone employee. The man in this scenario handles all of the burden and financial responsibility and thus retains complete control of the purse strings and children of the family unit. So as I've just mentioned, she is the perfect worker drone waiting to be acted upon by the free market. Businesses knew these women were conditioned via traditionalism to responsibility deferment. They could be apportioned to the most menial tasks, but by virtue of the novelty of their presence in the workplace, could flood the market with cheap, unquestioning labor, labor that was used to being content with an authority figure, this time not a husband, but a business entity keeping the lion's share of the profit, so long as she got her residual benefit of provision. Remember my theory that traditionalism and male-led families plus modernization and industrialization results in a bubble that, when popped, results in feminism, which is another bubble that will eventually pop itself. We often hear it said that a man who has a wife and children is a man with no loyalty to the state, that all of his loyalty is funneled directly to his family, and this is cited for why the nuclear family supposedly stems the tide of government largesse. Now, if this is true, then it's perhaps a temporary stemming of the tide, nothing more and certainly nothing permanent, because the destruction of the nuclear family that Western society has undergone is predicated on an incomplete analysis of the nuclear family. That is, the inspection of the loyalties of only one-third of the modern nuclear family, the question that's never asked. And I suspect that it's never asked because of man's fear of the answer. But the question to be asked is, where does the woman's loyalty lie in that same nuclear family? Adolf Hitler is quoted as saying, first you get the women, then you've got the children, so follow the men. Now, why would Hitler say this? Why would he say something like that? We're talking about a man who was keenly aware of how to control mass populations and how to inject his will into the public consciousness. So why then would a master mass manipulator like himself say that the perfect vector for gaining control of the masses is through the betrothed female? What would compel him to say this? Well, as we've discussed plenty of times before, the traditional woman is one in which her primary role is to act as a childlike facilitator of the will of a centralized male authority figure, in this case, her husband. What happens, though, when a competing central authority figure exerts its own pressure on her? Well, to answer this, we can first ask ourselves why it's basically a standard interrogation technique for law enforcement to separate male and female couples suspected of a crime and then relentlessly get to grilling the female. If this woman is a product of one of these infantilization processes that molds traditional women into the adult children most of them are, then her loyalty will align itself simply by who seems more authoritative at the time, which will of course be that of the men subjecting her to an increasingly threatening interrogation and the badges that adorn their lapels, which signify a coalition of many more men acting under the authority of the state. Remember that traditionalist women are trained to defer to male authority, get her away from the authority of her boyfriend or husband, and subject her to the authority of the state, and watch her spill her guts, and watch her tell them everything they want to know. You see, it is in the women of traditional nations that feminism coalesces. This is where feminism arises from, you know, once certain precursor conditions are in place, which I've described at length in previous videos. Remember that before the 1960s, feminism didn't exist in America, meaning that the women that embraced feminism when it came along were the women that knew nothing other than traditionalism before it arrived in America. We're talking about a self-perpetuating, female-catalyzed, organic dissolution of the family initiated by traditional women the moment they gain a modicum of financial freedom, courtesy of the ultimate provider-protector, the ultimate alpha male, the state. It's simple, really. The state seeks to expand. It does this organically. Women seek protection and provision wherever it's attainable, thus the state, who will always be able to provide more for women in general than any single provider male, will offer women so much protection and provision that traditionalist men cannot compete. The traditionalist approach simply has never planned for a scenario, an organic scenario, in which the state, in hopes of garnering female votes or income, used the same tactics that traditionalism employed. The reason Adolf Hitler could confidently predict that the way towards state control of the masses and the nuclear family is through the woman is because a nation's family structure is only as strong as its weakest link. He knew that men's loyalty to their families usually stay entrenched no matter what incentive the state will give them, and he also knew that women, due to their instinctive drive to respond to male dominance and whose deferment to male authority is socially groomed even further in traditional women, he knew that women would function as the Achilles heel of the nuclear family. They would function as the impetus for familial decay, and decay the nuclear family most certainly has, as our 50% divorce rate demonstrates. Furthermore, traditionalists claim a patent on the collected works of humanity that they've plagiarized off of a much more robust and fortified extended family. The modern nuclear family traditionalist is, suffice to say, very much removed from the actual tradition he purports to be upholding. We've been sold this lie that the nuclear family is the building block of civilization. This is false. The nuclear family is a relatively recent phenomenon, and it was actually its predecessor, the extended family, that is responsible for humanity's ascension from prehistory to the industrial age. The Wikipedia entry for the nuclear family refers to it as being synonymously called the isolated family, as well as the restricted family. Isolation and restriction being the key words in the moniker. You see, social conservatives portray the nuclear family as a strengthening or forming of familial bonds between an individual man and woman, when in actuality, it is a gynocentric dissolution of the extended. This family structure is the actual setup that has existed for millennia, the actual familial arrangement that started and maintained civilization for thousands of years. You'll notice that a common tactic of Western women is that of slowly driving a wedge between men and their families and their parents and their brothers and sisters and their cousins, slowly, you know, bit by bit, so that eventually he's left with nothing but her, you know, and her, well, I say the word her, you know, her children, because they certainly aren't his this day and age. They belong, children, just to make it clear, belong to women in the state. They are not male property. They haven't been since the advent of no-fault divorce, really. But yeah, you'll notice that tactic, Because when we're talking about things like the nuclear family, and if we seek to visualize it in the terms of an actual nucleus, you know, the actual nucleus in a molecule, we have orbiting electrons that serve as a stabilizer of the positive protons in the nucleus. So long as there's an interaction with electrons, the atom remains stable, it remains an atom. But if you begin removing electrons, the atoms ionize. It won't behave the same. Its characteristics will change. It's open to chemical manipulation and reaction. And so it is with the traditional family unit, the nuclear family, so to speak, where in the extended family, there exists older, wiser men and women on the periphery whom exert force, you know, and they influence, and they can influence the path of this smaller nuclear family if need be. But the fracturing of the extended family, which only occurs in sufficiently advanced societies where it becomes possible for one man to support a wife and his children by himself, gives rise to soulmate culture. The family degenerates into gynocentrism, and it revolves around and exists for the purposes of the perpetual courtship of a female. How can an individual woman in an extended family demand exorbitant amounts of the fruits of her husband's labor when he has loyalty also to the extended family, to the tribe, if you will? You know, the small familial community of sorts where his grandmother, who helped change his diapers when he was little, or his father, who taught him everything he knows about being a man, won't be getting packed in some nursing home to be forgotten about so that he can muster up enough money to get a big enough mortgage so that his parasite wife can have a big enough house with which to perform the only expenditure required of her in any advanced patriarchy, that is, the feat of childbirth. An individual woman, you see, can control an individual man. I mean, she can control him with sex or with the threat of divorce, but she can't, however, control a tribe. Thus, for the modern nuclear family to exist, the man must be deprived of proximity to his tribe. In many cases, not completely. You know, in many cases, you'll see the standard scenario where man meets wife, man moves, you know, two states away, three states away, and barely ever talks to his parents anymore and forgets to call grandma and so on and so forth. But it's all one big variation on splitting, on depriving the man of proximity to his tribe. Now, don't get me wrong, the extended family has its own problems too, and all of these familial setups are somehow, in some way, contradictory at one point in time or another to the will of the individual. But if I'm going to have to live in any kind of tribal arrangement where I can depend on people, you know, I want it to be my family, my blood. Not some woman and you know, her kids that belong to her in the state. And further yet, once one provides this same traditional female with a way of usurping her man's financial authority within the confines of this fractured nuclear family, one can watch her, drunk with power, turn her sights on and destroy her very own family, since all it ever was to her was a means of securing her own provision anyway. It was never anything more than that. Ask yourself, what effect did allowing women into the workforce have on traditional family units? Well, the same effect we observe of a teenage daughter, which upon acquiring her first job at some suburban mall kiosk, developing a sudden case of chip on her shoulder-itis. Because all daddy ever contributed was money and order anyway. So now she can do it too. Not in the same quantity that daddy does, but enough to challenge the foremost presence of male authority in her life. She, of course, still expects daddy to pay the rent, to buy her first car, to send her off to college on his dime. But she has, in acquiring employment for the first time, slightly devalued her father, who is, to her, the emblem of order and the emblem of power that she'll hate the instant one of his weaknesses become visible to her. The modern traditional relationship, being in actuality a highly dysfunctional pseudo-father-daughter relationship, reflects this. You know, as a traditional husband, you are the one responsible for meting out discipline in just the right way, you know, not too cruelly, or daddy's little girl will run away. But the benevolent dominance of the disciplinarian patriarch keeps the wife, who is an over-emotional, financially dependent child, aware of her boundaries. She respects him for setting those boundaries, so long as he remains potent enough to set them. Or, and this is the important part, an external source of male authority sways her. This is why women absolutely devour the whole, you know, independent woman meme. She's independent, she pays her own way, but you better keep paying that child support or alimony or whatever. You know, it's a child bragging about her little job, thinking it makes her superior to men, while men are still responsible for operating and maintaining the world around her. The following quote I'm about to give you, I got from a symposium from Brené Brown when she was studying the science of shame, and it crystallizes what we've been talking about when she relegates to us a dialogue she had with a father and husband at one of her book signings. She relegated that she didn't interview men for the first 4 years of her study, her study of shame. And she said that it wasn't until a man looked at her one day after a book signing and said to her, I love what you have to say about shame, but I'm curious as to why you didn't mention men. And she responded by telling him, well, I don't study men. And he said, well, that's convenient, sarcastically. And she said, why? And then he said, and I quote, because you say to reach out, to tell our story and be vulnerable. But you see those books you just signed for my wife and my three daughters? They'd rather me die on top of my horse than to watch me fall down off of it while riding it. When we reach out and be vulnerable, we get the shit beat out of us. And don't tell me from the guys and the coaches and the dads, because the women in my life are harder on me than anyone else. Now, I relate that exchange to you, not in hopes of getting women to change their behavior, but in hopes of men understanding where they stand in the eyes of women. Picture the world looking down at Atlas, you know, his back bearing the brunt of her weight. We know that Atlas will shrug sooner or later. His strength is not infinite. Picture the world then witnessing Atlas's first shrug and hating him before they even hit the ground, simply for finally shrugging. You know, how dare he? Again, it's hard to tell the difference as to whether or not I'm talking about a relationship between a father and a daughter or between a traditional husband and a wife. It's hard to say, isn't it? Since neither of these two familial scenarios represent an interaction between adults. There's only one adult present, and it's certainly not the wife. She essentially is the daughter in this case. And all this bolsters my suspicion that the feminism is the resultant of traditionalism and mechanization. Feminism, at least the financial after effects of it, are not a manipulation of the free market, but the free market acting on an artificially cultivated leisure class that traditionalism has created in its infantilized female. Traditionalism created an environment where half the population was not expected to work, and consequently, it was only a matter of time before 100% organic forces that dictate where the free markets would act upon in terms of how it searches for its employees, trained its sights on this artificial leisure class, and what followed is an organic poaching of this leisure class. Traditionalist men regarded this poaching as the fault of the state, their main beef being only that they have been outclassed by the state as sole provider to women. They're essentially mad that their little game of house has been exposed for what it was, a little lie, where they once had a monopoly on the dependency of the human female. They don't anymore. They don't anymore because women wanted it that way. So they gin up conspiracy theories about Fabian socialists and Marxists who apparently have enough clout over an extremely chaotic world to engineer the destruction of what they believed was an indestructible familial arrangement, and they simultaneously put the blame on and proffer the state as the single cause of the dissolution of the family, as well as the single solution via a well-wishing fantasy where politicians are elected to decrease the size of the state and everything magically goes back to the way it once was, when the United States and the West knew not of socialism and where the free markets reigned supreme. This has never been the case, of course. The United States, while implementing a great many capitalist directives, has since its inception been a mass consumer of socialist tendency. You know, forgive my little history lesson I'm about to embark on, but if we examine America from, I'm going to say the official start of the America we know today, of the year 1776, all the way up to the date of January 31st, 1865, when slavery ended in America, you know, although this slavery existed much prior to 1776, we're going to examine only the period after the Declaration of Independence. This gives us 89 years of America's founding century in which slavery existed. And in those 89 years, what America was by definition, a socialist slave state. You can point to whatever trade or markets or whatever else you want, but the fact remains that America began its first century as a socialist slave state. And what do I define as that? Well, we know that a free market is one where the fundamental ability for all individuals within the market to extract the fruits of their own labor must never be infringed upon. The moment one, even one individual is deprived of his ability to own his own labor, it ceases to be a free market. So in American slavery, we have a population of millions of slaves forced against their will to engage in a form of labor that only their slave masters capitalized off of. And if we wish to quantify that, at least in very unofficial estimates, we have 4 million slaves in America just before the Civil War. And I remember reading an article detailing the total energy output for an individual worker during the construction of the Great Pyramids at Giza as being estimated to be 2,400,000 joules of work energy per day. So if we use this value, the daily output of work in joules for the American slave population was 4 million times 2,400,000, which equals 9.6 times 10 to the 12 joules per day. And we're using the figure of 89 years for the duration of this slavery. So 365 times 89 gives 323,485 days of slavery. So if we multiply our two figures, 9.6 times 10 to the 12 joules times 323,485 days, this equals 3.11 times 10 to the 18th joules as an estimate of joules of work energy that African slaves were deprived of from 1776 to the passing of the 13th Amendment. And that's the equivalent. This is the equivalent, roughly, of energy output in joules of 49,293 Hiroshima bombs. So we're not talking about an insubstantial amount of labor that American citizens profited from, labor that African slaves were providing, labor that those same African slaves were entitled to. Thus, America cannot be said to be a free market at any point in this time period at all, as implied by the word socialist slave state. What America did was to nationalize a population of human beings where a slave master's only financial onus was one of the initial investment of his nationalized livestock, the African slave. From that point forward, much like a farmer collects all of the excess work an oxen produces after his initial investment, the slave owner collected in this same manner for the slave that he owned. The only problem is, of course, that slaves are not livestock, but people entitled to the same benefits of the free market as anyone else. Why am I telling you this? Well, because I believe it's important to understand that ever since the origin of this country, we haven't been a pure free market capitalist nation. I mean, even in the Fifth Amendment of the Constitution, we read that, quote, "No person shall be deprived of property without due process of law, nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation." And this is the basis for eminent domain laws that allow the state to forcefully nationalize land and resources belonging to the denizens of the free market, meaning private individuals and their private land they have acquired through capital gain by their labors can be nationalized against their will. The caveat of without just compensation is mentioned, and this of course makes it nonetheless socialist, considering that if a person simply does not wish to sell his property and it's still taken away, the compensation by its very definition cannot be just. So here we see the nationalizing of private property by the state comfortably nestled in the very language of the U.S. Constitution, and consequently we have another example of American socialist tendencies from inception. The United States has never been a free market capitalist state. It is capitalistic, and there's a very real difference. Now, again, I'm not making a judgment on what the United States should be. You know, to be honest, if it were left up to me and I did find a possible way to implement such a thing, I would most certainly, the small government crowd says, slash all sorts of government programs, try to get the government down to a small, because although I disagree with them in terms of the reality of the feasibility of what they're proposing, limited government without any real plan to bring this to fruition. I do think that the government is one of the major enemies of the individual man. But again, I'm not talking about what things should be. I'm only assessing what they clearly are, in that the United States is a capitalistic nation that will adopt socialist practice when it is overwhelmingly practical to do so. The United States military is a shining example of this, and this can be applied to any state with a national government military force. What is the United States military if not an American socialist government entity? We're talking about taxpayer dollars being used to provide protection. The state, of course, is the one with the authority to define when said protection is warranted, and thus any taxpayer who wants to rely solely on his or her own ability to protect oneself is being taxed anyway to fund the protection of others. He pays for the protection of his countrymen when he may only be interested in protecting himself. Perhaps what he pays in taxes for this military service could go to funding his own business instead of a nationalized socialist military force. So in this aspect, a nationalized military force is patently socialist. Remember that the state has, through non-competitive means, established a monopoly in the provision of a service, the service of protecting the American nation and people, and it's done this by forbidding any other competitors from providing that same service to the American people. Now, can one not make the argument that opening up free markets to whichever for-profit entities could provide better protection to the American people could potentially result in a better and more efficient military than the one we have now? But instead, are military acting in concert with private military manufacturers, we're talking Halliburton and Raytheon, offer up these no-bid defense contracts where taxpayer dollars are unilaterally awarded and apportioned by government to businesses of their choosing for the purposes of supplying military actions that the American people can only influence on the indirect level of the politicians they vote for. I mean, the amount of real control the average American citizen has over things like this is so minuscule, it's incredible. And yet most people, even the ones that harp on and on about how healthcare or Wall Street or whatever should be completely free of the heavy hand of government and privatized, most people still want that same hand of government involved when it comes to what is a socialist nationalized military defense force. And this nationalized military defense force is on the dime of the taxpayer, deployed in hundreds of foreign countries for the so-called purposes of peacekeeping, or in some cases even providing military training to armed forces of countries we claim to be at war with. So in this, our military socialism extends to the greater good of other countries as well. So when conservative proponents in the men's rights movement offer you the poorly thought out solution of a Mitt Romney vote as the path that men's rights should take, you should ask them why a man who by his own admission wishes to triple the size of the American military should be considered as an inhibitor of socialism and government largesse. And when they start giving you, you know, the classic, because most of these guys are way past military age or traditionalist women, this is why they have this penchant for supporting the military, because, well, they're past the age where they might have to serve, you know, and risk their lives. And of course, traditionalist women and all women aren't going to have to be on the front lines getting shot at. You know, it's always these people who are middle-aged, conservative types that love to talk about how great the military is. But of course, they'll never be drafted. They'll never be pressured by women or society at large to go fight and kill other men or be killed in war. So when they start to give you that spiel about how you know, in their age, the people knew that government should be limited and you know, should have the least amount of possible control over the lives of its citizens, remember that it was their generation. It was their generation that saw the most prolific mass draftings of men in American history. You know, let's talk about the draft, you know, which is fundamentally socialist in every possible sense of the word. I mean, you're talking about taking the life of a man and forcefully demanding that he kill other men or be killed himself. Where exactly, you know, was this great American spirit of American capitalism during Vietnam? When members of the American free market, of course men exclusively, were being denied a right systematically to their ability to perform labor, their ability to pursue employment where they wanted instead of being conscripted, their ability to start up their own businesses instead of enriching the state's military apparatus. And even today, the Selective Service functions as an index just in case we have to deprive men of their freedom again to go fight wars for years at a time in which those same men will not be able to compete for themselves in free markets. I mean, this is just pure socialism. The deprivation of a man's free will for the greater protection of society and women at large. It shows us, once again, that America, and this, when I say America, I'm really applying this to the entire Western sphere in general. America is willing to commit grievous acts of socialism, even up to the nationalization of human beings, as we saw in slavery and more recently with the draft. We're talking about even the nationalization of human beings as nothing more than military assets, and America very clearly maintains an index of its male stock for this very same purpose should the need ever arise again till this very day. Why is this socialism tolerated? Well, because, and only because, where the safety of the American public is concerned, the American people have been and always will be comfortable with operating under various degrees of socialism, and this can be applied to the entirety of the democratic West, everything from antitrust laws to OSHA to the EPA and FDA, NASA, breast cancer research, prostate cancer research, wildlife, forest conservation, government Pell grants, financial aid, healthcare. These are all examples of where different degrees of socialism and government regulation will be tolerated and wanted by the people against the tenets of capitalism, if need be. Because human beings actually want it that way, to some degree. Again, I'm not saying this is right or wrong, but I'm saying what is. And this is not due to some Marxist conspiracy. Again, this is what human beings actually desire to varying degrees. They desire plenty of capitalistic things as well, but this is what they genuinely want from society in certain aspects. Western civilization will dabble in socialism when it's beneficial to do so. China will have substantial capitalist tendencies despite it being a communist state. And with that said, what becomes apparent when taking this into account is that it's very easy to simply say, well, if we don't stop socialism or Marxism, Western civilization is doomed. You know, that all we need to do is return to free markets when we've never ever been there in the purest sense of the word in the first place. Now I'm saying all of this not because I advocate socialism, although, you know, just this very video is going to bring about various accusations that I do. I don't. But you know, I'm not naive to the destructive effects that can be brought about by socialism. You know, why I'm telling you all this is because it's imperative to understand going forward that at any given time we're living under various degrees of socialism and capitalism, and that our government, no matter how much black and white thinking we impose on its description, is some sort of hybrid of the two and always will be and always has been. Forget about making moral judgments on this. Let's simply just state a description of government as it exists in reality, not what we think it should be. And given that, it should then also become apparent that the true issue at hand here are disagreements between the American and Western electorates as to what degree of socialism, once accepted, becomes harmful to the fidelity of a nation. How much socialism can be adopted before it begins to stifle the organic forces of free market capitalism? How much socialism can we get away with, essentially? It may be possible that no amount of socialism can be introduced into the free market without it eventually inhibiting and destroying it, but we'll never truly know because on a long enough time scale, a social organism of the size and scale of a civilization will practice wealth distribution and taxation for the purposes of a greater good of some form or another. It will practice socialism no matter how capitalistic it is, period. If you don't believe me, prove me wrong. We have Rome, which centuries after its collapse has its legal philosophies deeply entrenched in American legal precedent, and this is held up as the standard of Western freedom. Rome, however, was built pretty much entirely by the labor of conquered slaves. No civilization, not one, not Rome, not Greece, not Egypt or Samaria or China or Japan, no civilization in human history has risen without the implementation of some socialist mandate somewhere in its history. And I'm trying to drive that point home because we're talking about a battle of the electorates here. With the advent of female suffrage, which I'm in full support of, by the way, there is for the first time an electorate whose biology compels it to garner its own security and provision, no matter how much of a burden it is to the rest of the electorate. You can say that women, as an electorate, taken in a general sense, are inherently socialist. It is said that women and feminism are not synonymous with each other, and it's absolutely true, they aren't. Not every woman is a feminist, and not every feminist is a woman. But the destruction of feminism cannot be brought about without an honest assessment of the link, and there is a link between the human female and feminism. Now, in keeping with our framing of these societal blocks as social organisms, picture feminism as a social virus. In the biological sense, a virus will spread through a vector. We're talking about pigs and rats, or, you know, through avian means even, or even through human means. If a virus's vector is geese, for example, we don't say that there's no relationship between this virus X and geese. We get to work on studying how this virus uses the biological hardware of geese to replicate itself. As such, we must look at the social virus and ask ourselves, what is the vector in the case of the feminist virus? The vector is unfortunately and undoubtedly the human female. Her biological software replicates and spreads feminism exponentially. It simply could not have proliferated without her. So this is not to say that feminism as a social virus couldn't have been engineered, as it has several key characteristics that hint towards that. But for one, we'll never truly know this. You know, if this is in fact the case that feminism was cooked up in some ivory tower by, well, you know, take your pick, whichever conspiracy theory best suits your agenda, the Rockefellers, the Marxists, the Jews, etc. If feminism was socially engineered as a societal virus, it was most certainly done so in a way that minimizes the work to be done by the social virus. Because like in the biological sense, any efficient virus must rely on the internal mechanics of its vector to reproduce itself. In the biological sense, a virus attacks a cell and uses the cell itself to trick it into reproducing the virus, after which the cell's contents can be used to go and infect other cells, and the cycle repeats and repeats. In the social sense, the feminist virus relies on its vector, women, for reproduction in the same manner. And this is why I shy away from conspiracy theories that bring up nondescript buzzwords such as cultural Marxism to explain feminism. If feminism was in fact engineered, the reality is that we have no way of proving it. But we do know that whether or not it was engineered, it's extremely effective and efficient. And it will continue to be whether or not someone cooked it up or whether or not it arose by completely organic means. So to say that women and feminism are not synonymous is done undoubtedly to show women sympathetic to the cause of the men's rights movement, that we don't put women in a singular oppositional category the way we do feminists. But the vector for feminism will and always will be through the female wherever it shows up. It cannot arise through the male. Although, where a fundamental understanding of the inner workings of the nature of women is ignored, as well as the nature of men, it will be helped along and encouraged by men at the cost of their eventual marginalization. But it will never arise through the male, ever. On the individual scale, women will have their own individual personalities and quirks and distinctions, but we're talking about the macro scale. The macro scale, where the societal organism of civilization and government reside. So the relatively recent advent of female suffrage will guarantee, in any democratic state, a move towards male-to-female wealth transfer that cannot be satiated by anything other than a keen understanding of an obsessive female instinct for protection and provision. Limiting the government will do nothing to abate its advance. The politicized female will continue her consumption of all resource until either the civilization collapses or it forces women to stand on their own two feet, both in terms of its relation to the state and culturally and specifically in regards to men. There can be no more providers. Truly, they need to be on their own. They must be given no choice but to sink or swim. And if this does not happen, limiting government will mean nothing more than a smaller prize to be consumed by the female horde. Now, the ironic part is of course, that men have always and will always be the biggest contributors to the prize of the accumulated wealth of government, and simultaneously, the only ones to ever refuse to demand their share of it. Now, you see this in a small government crowd particularly, another one of their poorly thought out moral platitudes about how the solution to men's rights doesn't lie in forcing the government to help men or to acknowledge and attempt to rectify men's issues. Men, they say, can stand on their own two feet and don't need the government to help us at all. All we need is for them to get out of our lives, etc., etc. You've heard the talking points. In the meantime, as I've discussed, their recommended political candidates will tax men to triple the size of the military. In the meantime, their political candidates will tax us to fund their Patriot Acts, which they themselves have identified as a breach of men's rights. I find it ironic that they cite the Patriot Act as a breach of men's rights and then vote for people who support the Patriot Act. But we've all discussed this before, you know, their tacit approval of hypocritical anti-freedom, anti-constitution measures by the candidates that they worship and essentially see as gods almost. But in the meantime, they're going to keep taxing us to keep us safe from the big bad terrorists and the drugs, and you know, they're happy to vote for all that. Yet if you mention to these same people that men should demand more government funding for prostate cancer research, this is somehow some odious dependency on the government that men can easily go without because, you know, we're men and we stand on our own two feet because, well, you know, I guess only socialists get prostate cancer, apparently. You know, I've been working since I was 14 years old. And since then, every single paycheck, every last one I received was magically garnished before I even received it by the United States government. So don't tell me that the government doesn't owe me anything. You know, if it doesn't owe us anything, if it doesn't owe men anything, then tell them to take nothing out of our paychecks. Tell them to never conscript another man ever again. Tell them to stop taxing us more than they do women. When they do that, then I'll say they don't owe me anything. Until then, I want to see men demanding government funds apportioned to research and development for a cure for prostate cancer, and not for amassing larger and larger militaries for excursions into sovereign foreign nations. Until then, I want to see men demand tax dollars to go toward research and development into male birth control pill technology, not into making sure that Israel's bills are paid. Until government is taxing both men and women on nothing more than what it takes to subsist on the most basic governmental skeleton possible, emergency services, infrastructure repair, etc. Until then it's men that are paying the majority of Western civilization's bills, and I want my money's worth. And as I've said before, decreasing taxes will not change the fact that men will always be the ones paying the most taxes. Until that changes, I want my money's worth. If, however, net taxation exists beyond the most basic expenses of government operation, then we want equal taxation of both men and women, or we will seek to deprive women of the tax dollars they insist on using that they did not work for. The reason that the small government crowd is essentially advocating for things that they couldn't possibly understand, either through laziness or because they just don't get it, is because the fact is that men are taxed at such a disproportionate rate when compared to women, that if government did in fact decide to stop taxing men in any substantial degree, the government would collapse in months. I mean, no politician, not a single one, is ever going to address men's issues. And additionally, no politician is ever going to suggest we stop taxing the ones covering the exorbitant costs of an expansionary runaway government. That is, of course, men. You know, I almost want Mitt Romney to win this election, not because I believe in a word of what he says, but only because I actually want to see what these idiots have to say when 4 years go by and, again, nothing happens. You know, I want to see what excuses they make this time around. You know, like the excuses the liberals are making for the fact that nothing changed under Obama. You know, I want him to get elected twice even. You know, I mean, I'm so confident in the predictability of these mainstream politicians' inability to make any significant change that I'm willing to patiently watch 8 years go by under their demagogues, simply to watch the egg on their faces when exactly what I said was going to happen. You know, until then, I have no further interest in watching these lemmings careen off of the cliff, and I'm generally done addressing them until their purposefully nondescript small government solutions fail to materialize time and time again. And to be honest, I'm actually glad to see a general trend emerging within the manosphere that isn't buying into traditionalism or conservatism, you know, at least the intellectually dishonest fake conservatism these slicksters have been trying to sell the men's rights movement on. And I can now, I think, accurately say that the majority of men in this thing we call the manosphere generally understand that marriage is no longer an option ever again, even if the laws change back. You know, and that a woman can and should pay their own damn bills like the rest of us. And that a free and thinking man can understand that a familial setup where he has to work and work and work while she enjoys the privilege of getting to raise children, pay nothing, and generally live a life of leisure is an unfair deal, bottom line. And to those that defend it, you know, you're more than welcome to live that life if that's what you wish. Just like I'm more than welcome to trade a Geo Metro for a Mercedes-Benz, my being content with the deal doesn't change the fact that I got ripped off. Understand that, you know, and know the difference between me attacking you personally and me attacking the ripoff you voluntarily signed up for. When you explain away the decreased life expectancy, the decreased time with your kids, the higher likelihood of on-the-job injury, amongst many, many other negatives, then we'll stop calling it a ripoff. Until then, that's exactly what it is. So this should end, for the most part, you know, and of course this will be constantly brought up as supplementary material in my future videos, but this ends, for the most part, my critique on traditionalism. I don't even want to say ends, because to be honest, I'm going to be talking about this pretty extensively in the future. So this ends formally, so to speak. I say I'll formally end my critique of traditionalism here. I'm glad you guys continue to tune into these videos. And I'm seeing very real effect taking place from your emails. They're encouraging. If you see me take a break or two that lasts a long time, you know, don't sweat it. I'm just extremely busy these days. So thanks for listening, and stay tuned.